Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. Tonight we have Natalie Cleaver speaking on Pico della Mirandola's oration on the dignity of man. She is a lecturer at the Department of Italian Studies at UC Berkeley, and she's going to be speaking about a subject which is extremely interesting, but an extremely interesting character right at the beginning of the Renaissance, and I'll let her give you all the details. Thank you, Natalie.
A microphone. Excellent. Okay. The first part of teaching is that you have to present material in some sort of intelligible way that people can learn it, right? And that actually is the easy part. The thing that everybody tells you is that you have to find some way to explain to your students why they should care about anything that you're trying to teach them. So it's a great honor to be here tonight with a bunch of people who think that philosophy is a good way to spend a Monday night so that you don't have to explain why we have to care. Is that better? Great. Excellent. Okay, so tonight I will be introducing you to this really foundational thinker of the birth of humanism in the middle of the Renaissance, or the middle of the Renaissance hell. It's an even great, portrait here is an anonymous portrait of this character, whose name is Giovanni Pico della Mirandola, is the proper Italian pronunciation of his name. Things with R's tend to be a bit difficult in Italian, so Mirandola will work. Giovanni Pico della Mirandola. One of the first places I ever stayed in Italy was a little town called, in Italian, Ferrara, but in English is Ferrara, which is really difficult to say. So, Giovanni Pico della Mirandola. What can you call him? Pico, which is usually mostly what he went by. This portrait is in the Uffizi Gallery in Florence. It was likely finished during his life. But we're not sure. Anonymous artist. Pico's most famous work is De Hominis Dignitate, written in Latin, the Oration on the Dignity of Man. The edition that I'll be using tonight is a brand new translation from last year, which I believe, no, they still kept the dignity of man. They often refer to it now as the Oration on Human Dignity, as a kind of attempt to maintain some of the ideas that Pico himself put forth about unity and these sorts of things. The oration was composed probably around 1486. It was, however, not published until 1496, after Pico's death, by a nephew of his. Should you get really excited about the oration, you can purchase this edition for a substantial sum of money, but it is a great scholarly edition with lots of notes. The editors are listed below. I'd like to begin by explaining a tiny bit of historical context for the oration, because it's really the period that produces both Pico and this work. So to give you some idea of exactly the environment in which it's produced, and then a tiny bit of background on Pico's life as well. So Pico was from a small town called just outside of Modena, which is in Emilia-Romagna, in Italy, but he is mostly associated with Florence. Here you see the baptistry in Florence, which is one of its only surviving medieval buildings. It dates from approximately 1115. So it's a very, very old building in terms of what we have left in Italy. It is, however, one of the only medieval buildings, largely because of the boom in Florence during the Renaissance, where the medieval architecture was completely built over. So, brief context. Why exactly where Pico is from or where he lived most of his life is important. So he lives in the 15th century, which in Italian is sort of familiarly called the century without poetry, mostly because it's sandwiched between the 14th century, where you get the three great crowns of Italian literature. They're called Dante, Boccaccio, and Petrarch. And the 16th century, where you get a real explosion of theater and poetry and epic poetry, writers like Machiavelli, Ariosto, and Tasso. So the 15th century is known as the century without poetry. This is not entirely legitimate. Pico himself wrote poetry, as did Michelangelo, for example. But it's known by that name because it's mostly famous for the philosophical endeavors of the period and the translations, especially of works from Greek. So, just to give you a brief idea, I've got some very rapid dates up here. Dante, Boccaccio, and Petrarch, these three guys in the previous century, The Florence as a republic is also a sort of important place. Florence as a republic is founded very, very early at a time when most of Italy is a series of warring communes at best. And this gives Florence kind of a head start. It becomes extremely wealthy. And by the turn of the 14th century, the beginning of the 14th century, it's a mercantile and banking center. Right? This is one of the truisms that we know about the Renaissance in Florence, right? But Florence is extremely rich, extremely rich. And it also has this rise of this merchant class, which means you have a lot of people who are literate, which is very unusual. It also means that there is more or less, during the 14th century, a constant state of war between either the popolo, the people, and the magnates, who are a series of very wealthy families, some noble, some merchants, or between the magnates themselves. Right. So while the 14th century is already has turned Florence into the center of cultural production, like the crown of Italy, at the same time it has all these internal conflicts, wars with its neighbors, Lucca, Siena, that are keeping a real stability from happening. And in the 15th century, the real thing that happens, the big important context for Florence, is that the Medici, the famous Medici, take over the Florentine Republic. This happens in 1434. Cosimo, the old, Il Vecchio, is the one who takes over the Republic, which remains a republic in name only. It is controlled by the Medici. This has while a sort of move towards tyranny in the mind of Machiavelli much later, it has the effect of creating much greater stability in Florence. Cosimo the Elder is most famous for being a patron of the arts in particular. You'll see Da Vinci is born here. His son, Lorenzo, who ultimately becomes in charge of the Florentine Republic afterwards, is more interested in philosophy, theology, and translating Greek works. Just to run through some of the stuff, 1462, the establishment of a sort of new Platonic academy. This is established by Lorenzo de' Medici, under the guidance of Marsilio Ficino, who's another major figure of Italian humanism. Lorenzo will be important later on. 1463, the fall of Constantinople. This is one of the key historical elements that prompted humanism, mostly because there were a ton of Greek refugees flooding into Italy, which suddenly made it possible to learn Greek, which was something most people did not have access to and had largely forgotten how to read. Petrarch, the last century, who was a very literate guy, prided himself on having a library of 300 manuscripts, which would have been enormous. One of those manuscripts was in Greek, and he would sort of lament how sad it was that he couldn't read this Greek manuscript. So one of the key elements of humanism is the ability to return to authors like Plato, for example, and to translate their works. Into all this mess, Pico is born in 1463. Very briefly, another one of the Medici takes over after Cosimo. He is not very efficient, not very interesting, and he dies very quickly. It's in 1469 that Lorenzo the Magnificent, who really is the sort of, you know, if Cosimo is Julius Caesar, Lorenzo is Augustus. He presides over Florence's greatest period of stability and an absolute explosion both in the arts and philosophy and literature. I think, yes, this is a portrait of Lorenzo by Bronzino, I believe. Get a look at all these attractive characters from the Renaissance. Lorenzo the Magnificent. Michelangelo shows up in 1478. There's something called the Pazzi Conspiracy. Anyone ever heard of this? There's this other really powerful family tried to kill the Medici, right? Tried to kill two of their kids, and there was a brutal retaliation that more or less wiped the Pazzi off the earth. Just to give you another, Florence wasn't absolutely within Medici control yet. So there's still another family trying to come to power. In 1484, Innocent VIII, who's the major pope that's important for Pico, becomes the pontiff. 1486, again, a really, really, really important year for Pico. But that's the year that Botticelli painted the famous Birth of Venus, right? So this is the world that Pico grew up in, right? Everything's possible, everything's changing, and everybody's making great art. it. Let's see. Where did we go? 87. Thank you. 87 is the year of the anticipated debate of the Conclusiones, which is a work by Pico of 900 theses. I will return to this and explain it. But this was the year that he anticipated debating it in Rome. In 1490, Pico persuades Lorenzo, the guy who's in charge, to bring some guy named Savonarola to San Marco. Anyone ever heard of Savonarola? Great. Great character. I mean, the Renaissance is just so awesome. It's just a litany of really fascinating people. And Savonarola, who's a Dominican monk, becomes extremely powerful because he's very, very popular in Florence. And this is, Pico meets him at a certain point. Actually, it's not entirely clear when. But he's something of a threat to the Medici power because he's so popular. There's a lot of public support. In the 90s, he starts to have difficulty with the Pope over some issues that were considered to be heretical. And we'll come back briefly to Savonarola. Let's see. Lorenzo's successor, 1492. Columbus is off doing his thing. And Lorenzo's successor, Lorenzo's still alive, but he hands over power to this other guy, Piero II, who also is grotesquely incompetent and causes a lot of trouble. Innocent VIII dies the same year, and Alexander VI, who is the famous Borgia Pope, Rodrigo de Borgia, becomes Pope. And in 1494, Pico della Mirandola and his friend, I'll get back to him later, Poliziano, both die. Pico is 31 years old, so I have outlived Pico della Mirandola. Also in 1494, the Medici are thrown out of Florence. A young Machiavelli is wandering around somewhere, supporting the newly reestablished real Florentine Republic. And this happens partially because Piero is incompetent and has been a bit tyrannical. I'll return to this later as well. And partly because Charles VIII of France invades Italy in the Italian War. This is a major trauma on the Italian consciousness. He caused a great deal of death and destruction, and the sort of war between two major Christian powers, on the one hand, was traumatic, philosophically speaking, and on the other hand, it just showed how vulnerable these Italian city-states were to a sort of unified monarchy. In 1498, the conclusion of the Italian War, mostly because Charles VIII dies, and nobody after him manages to get around to finishing off Italy, Savonarola also dies. He is hanged and then burned at the stake after a sort of popular turn against him that may or may not have been kind of plotted by the papacy. If you go to Florence, in Piazza della Repubblica, there is a plaque on the ground where it says, on this spot, on this day, the Florentines hanged and burned Girolamo Savonarola. So Florence is full of great stuff. Great characters in the Renaissance. 1512, much too, again, Machiavelli's sadness, the Medici return to Florence and to pretty absolute power for quite some time afterwards. This is when Machiavelli then writes his famous The Prince to try to get back into the good favors of the Medici. And I didn't really support the Republic. I love tyranny, gay tyranny kind of thing. And this is long after Pico's life, but just to, you know, kind of round off the period, in 1527, there's the sack of Rome. This is Charles V, the Holy Roman Empire Emperor. Oh, God. The Holy Roman Emperor. And this is really the concluding moment to a period of some extraordinary turmoil and some extraordinary characters. The sack of Rome is something that Italy takes a great deal of time to recover from. It also devastates Florence. Okay, so hopefully I didn't chatter on too much. Okay, so who on earth is this guy, Pico? He was called, by many people, the phoenix of his age. Again, died at 31, knew a staggering array of languages, not only Italian, obviously, or Latin, obviously, goes without saying in the period, but also Greek, very, very early in the history of Greek, the Renaissance of Greek, as well as, later in his life, Hebrew, Aramaic, and Arabic, all but unheard of at the time. So massively erudite guy. His parents, he's born 1463. His parents were Francesco I, the Lord of Mirandola, and the Count of Concordia as well. And his mother was Giulia Boiardo. This is a total side note because it's something I care about. But his mother's nephew, so his cousin, was a very famous Italian poet named Matteo Maria Boiardo, who wrote an epic poem in the same century called The Orlando Innamorato, which is worth reading. And Boiardo is much older than Pico. He was born in probably around 1401, and he died in the same year at the ripe old age of 93, 4. So cousins, but Pico's life tragically cut short in the same year. So his nephew, Pico's nephew, is somebody named John Francesco, who's important because he becomes Pico's biographer afterwards. He collects all of Pico's works. On the front page when I was saying that the Oration was not published until 1498, I believe, that was his nephew who published all of his works. In the biography, he says that the night that Pico was born, a circle of fire appeared over his mother's bed. This is a much later painting from the 19th century by Paul Delaroche, but it's the infancy of Pico. As you can see him already here as this sort of fat infant learning. I was trying to figure out what language is, but I can't really see the image clear enough. But learning probably Latin would be my guess. I mean, he's a little bit young for Greek. Yeah, so also his mother would likely not have spoken Greek. But just a kind of interesting reimagining of this from a later period. Okay, so in 1477, he's 14 years old, he goes to Bologna to study canon law. He spends 2 years in Bologna at a very famous university there. From 79 to 83, he travels around northern Italy, studies, writes poetry, gets smarter, keeps learning languages. In 1483, he inherits his family's money. Pico is one of the wealthiest men in Italy at the time. He is also possibly one of the wealthiest Italians in history. He has two brothers who have a colossal fight over the estate. He mostly stays out of it, and then when it's finally settled, he handed over administration of the estate to one of his brothers so that he could just have money, but live the contemplative life, not the life of care, of worrying about how to deal with farms or banking or whatever it is that people did back in the time. So in the same year, 1483, he's invited to Florence by Poliziano, who's another very, very famous figure of Italian Renaissance humanism, a great poet and thinker. And he spends the next couple of years immersed in the Medici court, particularly influenced by Ficino, Marsilio Ficino, the reemergence of Platonic philosophy. This is Marsilio Ficino. This is a portrait actually by Da Vinci. Caveat. Actually, we think it's Ficino. There's a bit of disagreement about this, but we'll call him Ficino. But the portrait by Da Vinci, Ficino. 1585, 86, he toddles off to Paris, studies at the Sorbonne very briefly, gets even smarter, probably learns French, who knows, and then comes back in March of 1486. This is the moment in which he conceives of his great idea, which is he has written, or is in the process of writing, 900 theses. These are called the conclusiones. He wants to go to Rome, and this is how rich he was, pay for a conference at which everybody is welcome. All the famous people, all the doctors, all the theologians, all the clergy, everyone is invited. And he wants to stand there and defend his 900 theses against anyone who wants to challenge him. He's 23 years old. Okay. So he has this idea. He writes to the Pope, Innocent VIII, and it seems like, you know, things are sort of set up. So on May 8th, of 1486, he leaves for Rome to prepare for this debate. Somehow he winds up in Arezzo, which is not on the way to Rome, and he abducts somebody's wife. Her name is Margherita. She was a widow a very wealthy widow that remarried somebody that Pico clearly thought was sort of below her status, kidnaps her, runs off with her. It's not clear if she went with him voluntarily and they had a thing, or if it was a genuine kidnapping, but more or less his friends come to him and say, hey, you're not going to get away with this. You're causing really big trouble and possibly a war. And she goes back to her husband. Pico goes into hiding for a little bit. Mostly this is smoothed over. I mean, he could well have been executed for this. This was a big deal. But mostly it's smoothed over by Lorenzo, who's running Florence, who's very fond of this 23-year-old kidnapping, writing a feces guy. So December 7th of the same year, he finally winds up back in Rome. And the conclusiones are published. So this is before the debate. And this was a mistake, it turns out. Once they're published, there's a huge controversy, mostly over the fact that a lot of them are full of things that were considered heresy. The conclusiones were condemned to be burned at the stake. You can burn books at the stake, too. There was a warrant sent out for his arrest. There was a bit of confusion over this because ultimately it was annulled, but nobody knew this. In the meantime, he ran off to Paris and hid for like a year, and then he manages to come back after the whole thing sort of sorted out. But it's a very bizarre situation. The following year, in the same year, Innocent VIII says, you're not having a conference. You know, you've caused enough trouble already. There's a committee convened to judge the orthodoxy of Pico's work. They point out a number of things that are not orthodox or acceptable. And Pico, in 1487, writes an apology that does not apologize for anything. Mostly it defends everything he said. But, you know, he gets away with all this, amazingly. And he returns to Florence in 1488. Oh, wrong slide. Okay. He returns to Florence in 1488. So this is where Savonarola comes in. He seems to have undergone a genuine conversion of sorts, Pico. He's increasingly under the thrall of Savonarola. And seemingly genuinely, he writes a series of works that turn back towards something more like Orthodox Christianity, including a treatise against astrology, which he's always opposed, actually. Pico's a very anti-astrology, very anti-bad magic kind of guy. But he seems to have undergone a period of genuine repentance. It's in 1494 that he dies. Savonarola is actually at his deathbed, another 4 years to go before he's executed. And it's the same day Pico dies that Poliziano dies, his friend, the other poet, but also Charles VIII arrives in Florence. This is a pretty catastrophic sort of day for Florence and for Pico. Pico and Poliziano, it turns out, were both poisoned. There's a lot of speculation on who poisoned them exactly. It seems like, actually no, not Savonarola. It doesn't seem like it. It seems like it was probably the Medici. This is Piero now, the second, who is a bit of a tyrant, can't really stand anybody being more popular than he is. Somebody last century exhumed both of their bodies and they were both poisoned with arsenic. So they demonstrated. I don't know how people get grant money to do this kind of stuff. But yes, they were categorically poisoned. So, and then the last sort of tiny biographical thing here is that in 1496, so 2 years after his death, is when his nephew publishes his complete works. Right? So this is this craziness that Pico lives in. It's a really amazing time. The life, the biography that was written of him by his nephew was translated into English by Sir Thomas More. Thomas More also translated a lot of Pico's letters and a handful of the rest of his works. So, all right, enough. So the Oration on the Dignity of Man, what does this have to do with the 900 Theses, was supposed to be his opening address, right? He was going to stand there in this room full of everybody he could get a hold of, and this was his, like, opening salvo. This is what the oration is. So it's a speech, essentially, that he never got the opportunity to give. And it's a terribly, terribly, insanely complex text. Again, because of how erudite he was, constantly refers to, you know, people I haven't even heard of years later. I mean, it's very dense and it's very difficult. But I'd like to just kind of break it down into a couple pieces to sort of explain some of the more important moments in it. But historically speaking, there are two reasons, really, that the Oration is an important text, right? And probably you haven't heard of Pico della Mirandola, but he's very important in the development of European history. So these two reasons both have to do with the word humanism, right? The first reason is a historical use of the word humanism to mean this period of rebirth of Greek, of classical knowledge. This text represents everything that we think about when we think about the word Renaissance, right? And this is why I have David up here, right? The kind of brash glorification of humanity, of the idea of being human, that we find in the Oration is exactly the same idea that we see in David, right? This is this vision of, like, the Renaissance is the rebirth of caring about being human, right? The trite things that we say about the absence of oppression, like a move away from the church towards rationality, towards art, towards philosophy, all these things, right? So that's all in the Oration. In fact, the Oration is often called the manifesto of the Renaissance, right? The other thing that the Oration represents that has to do with this definition of the Renaissance is the sense of loss that's generated by the Middle Ages. Because at this point, I mean, Renaissance, the rebirth, right? The rebirth of what? The rebirth of classical learning, right? Once upon a time, people knew things. They knew how to build things. They knew how to think about things. And then it disappeared for centuries, right? So when you actually hit the Renaissance, there's this terrible sense of, like, grief and loss. And, like, how do we reach back over this period of darkness to get those things back? Right. The reason I have Florence up here is this building was, in fact, it was probably mostly finished, actually, during Pico's life. This is Santa Maria del Fiore in Florence, and that dome is Brunelleschi's dome. And Brunelleschi lives mostly in the early part of the 15th century. He is an architect and a painter and the true Renaissance man, just like Pico. And he travels to Rome, and he sees the Pantheon, a little dome that still exists, and he said, I can do that. Right? And it's the same attitude that makes the Oration, this I can do that, they did it, that makes the Oration the manifesto of the Renaissance. Okay. One final thing about the Renaissance. This is a copy of the 1498 first edition of Pico's works. People get very excited about manuscripts. I actually prefer early books. They're really amazing to see in person, but they don't have pretty drawings and stuff. The other tiny thing that's different about Pico that marks the separation with the Middle Ages isn't the going back and citing old stuff. Okay, so in the Middle Ages, it's actually a very common way to write, to reach back and you say, I say X. X is true because the following 13 famous people said X, and then you list them and quote them. It's quite tedious. This is you pick established authorities, which is where a word author, in fact, comes from. Those established authorities were by and large Latin writers and writers of the church. The difference, however, between Pico and that kind of writing isn't just that he used a much wider range of text. It isn't just that he cited Greek authorities and the Chaldeans or Arab sacred scripture, right? It's that his mode of reading is that it isn't the church that says something is a good text. He reads all of this stuff and he says, I say this is right. And this is a fundamental shift in the way people, it's an individual judgment that he's exercising. And this is a colossal difference between the Middle Ages and the Renaissance. It's huge. So the other second reason that this text is so important, I think, for us now, this has been a huge rebirth of interest in Pico about now, as well as there was also one during the 1930s. One is because we've come to understand him, and I think this is a bit anachronistic, but true as well, in a different way, but we've come to understand, we sympathize with the way that he finds value in human life, right? The way we casually use the word humanism, a humanistic approach. And with an attempt that we see in him to find unity in difference, right? Which again, I have some hesitation about this because Pico's use of, say, the Quran doesn't validate the Quran. That's not what he's doing. But I think we see him now as a kind of model for the same sort of discourse in our society about how to find the ability to talk across faiths, right, or interact across faiths. The problem is, of course, that these categories shift constantly. And I've been thinking about this bumper sticker a lot lately, mostly because it struck me that the goal here is really quite modest, this idea that you coexist, right? Whereas Pico is really after a fundamental, quintessential essence of truth, that is to say, unity that exists behind all of these things. So, anyway, moving along to the Oration on the Dignity of Man. As I've just nattered on forever about the context. I've sort of broken up. The oration is not broken up. Like I said, it's a speech. I've broken it up into a couple of different categories to try and explain about what the major arguments are. So Pico's first question is, you know, he says man is the greatest thing ever created, above the angels, right, as opposed to Psalms, which is that man was created a little lower than the angels. In the medieval world, the natural world, is a creation of God, right? And therefore, it reflects the order of God's mind, which is what makes it okay to study biology, right? But the counterpoint to that is that man is created to worship God, which is not at all what Pico says. This is very bizarre. And the greatest gift traditionally to human beings is the gift of free will. Pico changes this quite a bit. His reasoning, he says that God sets man above all of his other creations, right? Quote, "At length it seemed to me that I had come to understand why man is the most fortunate of beings and therefore worthy of all admiration." Man, right? You can already see why he gets into trouble. "And what finally is the condition that befell him in the universal order? A condition to be envied not only by beasts, but even by the stars and the intelligences dwelling beyond this world." So in Pico's account, God, which is an amalgamation of all these different creation accounts, God creates everything in the world. He creates the lower beasts, the earth, the universe, the divine intelligences, that is to say angels. And then he thinks, I need something that will marvel at this world. Right? Not something to worship me, but something that will marvel at my act of creation. And he decides to create man. But the problem is, he says, man needs to be able to marvel at his own self, right, as well as the world. So what can I give man that's so special and so unique that he will be completely distant from all of my other creations? God, however, realizes that he has given every attribute of himself to something in the universe. So he's got nothing left unique to give humans. So instead he decides to give human beings the potential to be anything in the world. Quoting again, "At length the Master Creator decreed that the creature to whom he'd been unable to give anything wholly his own should share in common whatever belonged to every other being. He therefore took man, this creature of indeterminate image, set him in the middle of the world, and said to him, 'We have given you, Adam, no fixed seat or form of your own, no talent peculiar to you alone. This we have done so that whatever seat, whatever form, whatever talent you may judge desirable,'" here again is this quality of individual judgment, "'these same may you have possessed according to your desire and judgment. Once defined, the nature of all other beings is constrained within the laws we have prescribed for them. But you, constrained by no limits, may determine your nature for yourself, according to your own free will, in whose hands we have placed you.'" This word, indiscretus, in Latin, seems to refer back to a specific Greek word. The sense of it is not indetermined, but undecided. This is, again, different than the traditional Christian account where man is created in God's image. Pico will make up for this a tiny bit by suggesting more or less that God's image is equally everything, right? Not equally indeterminate, but the way that we become like God is to become like all of these things, to fulfill all of these potentialities. It's quite extraordinary sort of statement. He then goes on to talk about this category, this quality of man as chameleon. So we are like a microcosm, right? We have all of these things. We can be vegetable, animal, all the, you know, angel, like the angels. This part here says, if man, that is, cultivates his sensitive seeds, he will become a brute animal. Sensitive, like a feeling, right? If he cultivates his rational seeds, he'll become a heavenly being. If he cultivates his intellectual seeds, he will be an angel and a son of God. And if he, again, so scandalous, being dissatisfied with the lot assigned to any other creature, gathers himself into the center of his own unity, thus becoming a single spirit with God in the solitary darkness of the Father, he who has been placed above all other things will become superior to all things. This is Pico's sort of backward way of saying how man can become like God. I'm going to skip the next two sections because I've talked way too long. The life of angels. Strangely, when Pico decides, he's like, so how do we do this? You know, let's have a concrete plan of action. He's like, I know, let's talk about the angels. This is very weird. And then he goes on about the angels for a while and different kinds of angels, thrones, cherubim, seraphim. The issue ultimately is that we need to, the contemplation is ultimately where he comes down. That we, in order to judge or to love, we need first to understand, and this requires contemplation. The metaphor of the ladder is an equally sort of... this is really where the oration gets a bit arcane. But what we need, he said, that we need to be like the angels who can go up and down and up and down this ladder to God. And ultimately what he decides that this ladder represents is the need for peace. And peace is the thing that he sees is represented only through unity, which again is what this whole intellectual project is about, right? What's the answer? Like, if we sort through all the other difference, what's the thing, the kernel, right? And Pico's a bit mystical too. But what's the kernel left at the end? Just quoting from his bit on peace. This is that most holy peace, the indissoluble bond, the harmonious friendship in which all souls, in one mind, are not only in agreement, but indeed, in a certain ineffable way, inwardly become one. Let us desire this peace for our friends, for our times. Let us desire it for whatever home we enter. Let us desire it for our souls, so that in her may be made a house of the Lord. But, okay. He then goes on to a defense of philosophy, right? So then he says, I wouldn't even bother to do this, because any idiot can see that the best thing to do with your life is study philosophy. But there's so many people who've been detracting my project here that I will defend it. And he goes on to explain how he's never done anything but pursue philosophy just because of a love of it. He's never been contaminated by any filthy desires for money, for example. Mercifully, he had no desires for money, so it's always a little bit easier. But he was only seeking the nourishment of his mind and the knowledge of truth. And there he does make reference to the fact that he's given over control of his family estate to his brother, so that he doesn't have to be muddied about in the kind of worldly affairs of dealing with filthy practical matters. So, there's one tiny part here I just want to read. He says, for philosophizing, I think, what if these people could live to see us? For philosophizing as a whole, and this is the misfortune of our age, is now derided and disparaged instead of being honored and glorified. Thus, nearly everyone's mind has been invaded by the ruinous and monstrous conviction that either no one or only a very few may study philosophy. As if having before our eyes and at our fingertips the causes of things, the ways of nature, the logic of the universe, the divine plan, the mysteries of heaven and earth, were of no value whatsoever unless accompanied by the possibility of garnering some favor or making some profit. Again, remember that this is his introductory speech that defends his project. He identifies three criticisms of his 900 theses. The first is that public disputes are a bad idea, because it's just a case to show off, It's not a case to get anything done or talk about anything serious. And he says, well, fine, but if that's true, then it's a mistake that all the big philosophers have made, so I'm in good company. Yeah. Second objection is that at 24 years of age, he's too young. You know, the kind of, how dare you? Oh, he's 24. I was 23. Yeah, he's too young. Anyway, he's too young. He quotes two passages of scripture, Job, this idea that there's a spirit in men and the inspiration of the Almighty that give us understanding. And, of course, Timothy, let no man despise your youth. He then has this sort of pseudo-humility here, where he says there's nothing particularly special about him, though. So number three, the other challenge is that even if he's got the right to sort of hold this public debate, it's ridiculous that he's proposing 900 theses to defend, right? Which I kind of agree with, frankly, having had to slog through them at some point. And this one seems to be the one he's twitchiest about, right? So he really goes on and defending himself on this charge. He says, first of all, the burden is on his shoulders, not anyone else's. So, you know, it's not your problem. It's unseemly to wish to restrict the ambitions of others. He says, whether he succeeds or fails, it's no more blameworthy to do so with 900 theses than with 10. Seems like a fair point, actually. He says that even if his strength fails, his audacity will surely be praised. And audacity is this other Renaissance category, right? It's Brunelleschi who goes to Florence and says, I can build this. Give me a bazillion dollars. You know. He says, at least that if his theses are numerous, they're precise and clearly outlined. They're not. And he says, finally, in conclusion, he says, we cannot rightly choose between doctrines and answers if we do not know all of them. And that his personal approach to philosophy wishes, quote, not to swear by the words of another, but to pore over all the masters of philosophy, to examine every page, and to become acquainted with all schools. This is, again, the sort of return on an individual level to this idea of judgment. Just skip over this. Blah. And then we had the... Yes. His final concluding moment in the oration. This is very simple. He says, you know, what would be the point if I just recapitulated to you all the things that we know and agree on, right? This is time for me to bring something to the table, to the banquet. The banquet is a sort of standard metaphor for this kind of philosophical discourse, right? So it's important that even if I'm wrong or not right, it's important that I bring something. And these are the things that he says that are his own unique accomplishments in the 900 theses, so you don't have to work through them. Proofs of the agreement between Plato and Aristotle. He doesn't really do this, and supposedly he did another work that we have subsequently lost. So, and that was a big debate that just still goes on and on. So, you know, he didn't resolve that one. But 72 new theses in physics and metaphysics. 74 theses, both old and new, on mathematics, by which he really means numerology. Then some theses on magic and its two forms. Pico was very anti-magic as we would currently conceive of it. And he wrote a couple of works on witches, witchcraft, and demonology. But he distinguishes between two forms of magic. Magic that is a kind of science that perhaps we just don't understand yet, which again is a kind of idea that appeals to us in a very modern way, right? Or magic that's actually based on the power of demons. And then the theses on the explication of the Kabbalistic mysteries. This is something I haven't, you know, really talked about too much, but Pico was fascinated by Kabbalah. And he was one of the earliest people in Italy to have access to the Kabbalistic books. It's definitely one of his more original contributions. And then this is just simply the conclusion to his final oration, his last stand before entering into the fray. There can be no doubt that it is neither modest nor in keeping with my character, which is modest. This I shall nonetheless declare, since those who envy and speak ill of me compel me to do so, that I have resolved through this Congress of mine to demonstrate not so much that I know many things as that I know things that many do not know. Ouch. Who listens to a 24-year-old talk like this? You know, you can see why he made people angry. So that this may become clear to you by facts, most reverend fathers, and so that my oration no longer postpone the object of your desire, most excellent doctors, whom not without great delight I see ready and girded up spoiling for a fight, Let us take up our arms as if to sound the battle trumpet, and may the outcome be fruitful and favorable. So even though there's, you know, it ends on this kind of note of, even though earlier he's talked about friendship and this importance of unity and having philosophical discussions in terms that are accessible to everyone and that it's a real attempt to get to the truth, here at the end you're left with this very martial image, again, of girding for battle, and it does not seem like the kind of friendship that expresses unity. So I should conclude here. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and I'd like to remind our audiences on the radio and online that they're listening to Natalie Cleaver speaking about Pico della Mirandola's Oration on the Dignity of Man at the Commonwealth Club of California. It's time for questions.
That was wonderful, Natalie. Thank you so much for introducing us to Pico. A simple clarification. Who is he referring to by fathers and doctors? Is it what we mean today or something else?
Fathers of the Church, certainly. And doctors would just be people who are educated. Like we were just talking about earlier, how we are all doctors here. The reason that when you have a PhD, they call you doctor is that it comes from the word for learned. So yes, fathers of the church and doctors as in people who are educated.
So Pico is well known for his involvement with Neoplatonic studies. And I guess my question is, was most of his learning Greek that drove him in a different spiritual direction from his contemporaries?
It's so absolutely impossible to say. It really is. I mean, you know, Greek is the thing that's being reborn all over. I would say for somebody like Ficino, for example, it is Greek. It's Greek philosophy. Then Ficino translates all of Plato. He writes 18 volumes on Platonic philosophy. And Pico disagrees with Ficino substantively at moments. It's really difficult. I mean, the sheer vastness of the kinds of texts that he used and makes reference to. But I, the best I can do is point you in the direction of the conflict between him and Ficino. But they were great friends, but they hardly ever agreed about anything.
I was just thinking of the relationship between humanism and the term humanities for a study. Can you talk about how long we've used the term humanities, and is it connected to that time?
You know, you've just asked me one of those questions that I'm super embarrassed about. Since the classical world, there are a couple of different systems for talking about like spheres of knowledge that one acquires. One of which is the seven liberal arts, which I think is probably where we get the idea of the humanities from today. But they go through so many different iterations, and I will not try to list all seven because I invariably get them confused. But that at least goes back to the Greeks. Yeah.
Came down with the educational system that came down from the Greeks, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
But
I understand.
Exactly. Which Pico never resolved, so yeah, what are we going to do?
I have an understanding that there's some history of Pico defending, protecting the Jews of Italy.
There, you know, I'm not remembering the story at the moment. There's one particular story about his involvement with a Jewish, I think, rabbi that he met in Bologna. But I do not remember the details. Certainly, I mean, the fact that we're kind of like, oh, he spoke Greek, Hebrew, Arabic, oh, you know. But the study of Hebrew was extremely rare. And I imagine that this opened an entire world of culture to him that most people never had access to. It really isn't until the beginning of the 17th century, around 1600, with the translation of the King James Version of the Bible, that scholars who were not Jewish started studying Hebrew. I do not, however, recall the details of the story.
Questions? Other questions? Okay.
This is perhaps just a little off topic, but you mentioned the fall of Constantinople. What was the view of contemporary Italy toward that event?
That is a very good question. You know, this is one of those moments where you kind of bump up against the limits of your discipline. And what's one of those reasons that interdisciplinarity is so important? Because to my mind, the fall of Constantinople almost exclusively means, hey, we can all learn Greek now. And I really don't know as much about the kind of political impacts that it would have had. Certainly economically, places like Florence are so well off that there, no amount of immigration at that point in time would have had any effect. I do know that it's one of the reasons that Venice, ultimately in the 16th, 17th century, becomes such a huge power. It has a lot to do with the influx of quite wealthy people, of quite talented people, to Venice after the fall of Constantinople. We should all strive for interdisciplinarity, and I should study more history and economics as well. Absolutely.
A vast exodus of Christians out of Constantinople back toward Western Europe.
Absolutely. Oh. Absolutely. In the direction of the church would have been the idea. Yeah.
I heard, and this is, history comes down in imagery that's sometimes somewhat accurate, sometimes inaccurate. But I heard many, many decades ago that the start of the Renaissance was due to the fact that there was a sort of professorial colloquium going on in Florence in 1463, and that when Constantinople fell, all these professors were out of their jobs, and they were then hired by the Medici. And you said that there was such an influx of Greek that many people started to speak Greek. Have you ever heard this imagery of it?
I think that's the what's referred to as the new Platonic Academy that Lorenzo and Ficino founded. Mm-hmm. Ficino somehow learned Greek before that. There were not no Greek-speaking people in Italy, but it's definitely that that's the driving force forward for this just huge explosion of interest in ancient Greek culture.
I would like to imagine a bunch of professors here in San Francisco from London, and then London getting cut off, and they all had to stay. Would they get jobs or not?
I'm just thinking that with all the turmoil that was going on regarding the persecution that was going on in Spain and all of that, and his whole concept of unity and, it was very broad, totally the antithesis of what the Catholic Church was talking about. I'm surprised to let him live that long.
Well, he did die poisoned, so we can all speculate there. And certainly he took the arrest warrant that was sent for him quite seriously. He hoofed it to France as fast as possible, out of the theoretical grasp of the papacy.
But then came back? Or did
he did before he died, yes.
Before he died. All right, there's time for about two or three more questions.
Did the bonfire of the vanities, Savonarola's burning of everything, did that take place while Pico was still alive?
I am not sure. A quick Google search, I challenge you, would turn up that information. I don't know. I see a hand.
Yes, the indexing method that was shown there, was that Pico's indexing method? And if so, was it based upon an indexing that was known at the time, say a compendium of the various arts and sciences?
Do you mean the my division of the subject matter of the oration, or do you mean rather his categories of the new things that he's contributing at the end?
I saw numbers, for example, 1 through 35 belong to the first.
That's me, absolutely. I was trying to sort of structure the main points of his argument. The oration is a speech, right? So it's not divided. God knows what interesting rhetorical devices he might have used had he had the opportunity to give this speech. But no, it's not divided at all. Those numbers refer to the sentences, actually, of the text.
Well, there's a lot of background on how he did it. Were there some ideas he was most proud of being new or unusual, and that he said, this is really what I want everybody to take away instead of all 900?
I can say a few of the things that were widely considered to be heretical afterwards. One was he had some strange ideas about transubstantiation, which in some ways anticipates some of the concerns of the Reformation. He also said that it was wrong to worship any image or object, such as a cross, which is again a kind of iconoclastic impulse that we'll see echoed in the Reformation. I mean, Pico's not a church reformer. He's a thinker. He's actually not even that. He's more concerned with his concept of philosophy than he is with the behavior of the church, right? But those are at least two ways in which we see the Reformation coming, sort of.
Was it a university at that time or an academy, and what was the connection, if any?
In Bologna, there's quite a famous, supposedly the oldest university at Bologna. I mean, he did study at the Sorbonne in Paris as well. He also studied at the University of Padua at some point when he was doing his very rapid turn around Italy. In Florence, I'm actually not positive what the state of the Florence University was. Again, there's this academy that's founded by Ficino, but that seems to be a way for sort of wealthy people to hang around and talk about things. It's Ficino, it's Poliziano, it's another great Italian poet named Luigi Pulci, and it's ultimately Pico as well, although he's by far, again, the youngest one in the room, you know. You can see him sort of feeling that he's constantly the smartest person there.
Time for one last question. Anybody like to ask it?
Again, knowing that Pico had so many different sources that he read, but what struck me was the quote that you had up there, which almost indicated, not now, but earlier on, which almost seemed to indicate even perhaps a neo-Buddhist approach to existence and life and being, which may have come to him from the Arabic, perhaps?
Yeah. Like I was saying, I think this is one of the reasons that we've seen such a resurgence of interest in him, because of this attempt to find some sort of unity, but universal truth that will give us common ground to talk. Right? And I think that's why he means so much for our moment now. But yes, to whatever extent he would have had access to something like Buddhism, it would definitely have been through the Arab world at best. Even Pico didn't speak all the languages.
I'd like to thank Natalie for having taken us back 500 years and shown us that the same questions are always being asked. That is, you know, why is anyone interested in philosophy? And to give an answer that it is interesting, is intrinsically interesting, and it never gets answered, and therefore that's part of the reason. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
And so ends another event at the Commonwealth Club of California in its 110th year of enlightened discussion.